On FM, we continue our book of the week, Queen of the Desert by Georgina Howell. For Gertrude Bell, much of 1919 and 1920 was characterised by feelings of anger at the ill-informed decisions being made in Europe over the Middle East. At the same time, her relationship with the British Civil Commissioner in Baghdad, A.T. Wilson, became increasingly fraught. But fortunately, he left nation-building and took a job with an oil company.
In October 1920, Sir Percy Cox returned to Baghdad.
It is quite impossible to tell you the relief and comfort it is to serve under somebody in whose judgment one has complete confidence. Oh, if we can pull this thing off, rope together the young hotheads and the sheer obscurantists, enthusiasts, polished old statesmen and scholars, if we can make them work together and find their own salvation for themselves, what a fine thing it would be. I see visions and dream dreams.
Once the British mandate in Iraq became official, a leader needed to be found who could hold the country together in the name of the Arabs. Effectively, there were only two families in Arabia from the ruling traditions, the Sauds and the Hashemites. Ibn Saud was already too powerful for the liking of the West, and his Wahhabi puritanism had no foothold in Mesopotamia, whilst most Iraqis were ignorant of the Hashemites, who had no history east of the Hejaz, the coastal region of Arabia which included Mecca and Medina. In May 1885, when Gertrude was 16, a baby was born in his father's castle in the deserts of the Hejaz and named after the flashing downstroke of the sword, Faisal. What were the odds that a schoolgirl from Yorkshire and a son of the Hashemite Sharif of Mecca should ever meet, or that their lives would become interwoven? Faisal was the third son of Sharif Hussein ibn Ali, continuing the bloodline of the Prophet Muhammad. Sharif was the family's honorific title. The Prophet's family had held temporal rule in Mecca for the last 900 years. T.E. Lawrence, writing in his great book, The Seven Pillars of Wisdom, described his search for a leader. "So I went down to Arabia to see and consider its great men. The first, the Sharif of Mecca, we knew to be aged. I found Abdullah too clever, Ali too clean, Zaid too cool. Then I rode up country to Faisal and found in him the leader with the necessary fire. I felt at first glance that this was the man I had come to Arabia to seek, the leader who would bring the Arab revolt to full glory." It was in the aftermath of the war and at the Paris Peace Conference that the promises made to Faisal began to unravel. Lawrence and Gertrude had not known about the secret agreement to divide territory into areas of French and British influence. The Sykes-Picot agreement rendered the British undertaking that Faisal should reign over Syria as hollow, and in Paris, Faisal was shabbily treated by the French. Gertrude was introduced to Faisal by Lawrence. Dressed in his habitual gold-embroidered white, carrying his ceremonial dagger, and with the air of command and the mystique she had expected, he was the type of desert Arab to whom she had always been attracted. A veteran warrior of 33 years, experience and betrayal had accentuated his air of melancholy. Gertrude spent a couple of hours talking to him one morning as he was sitting for Augustus John, who had taken a studio in Paris to paint the most interesting of the delegates.
"In John's studio, I told him that I believed that no power on earth would make France relinquish the Syrian mandate. He had received this opinion with surprise and dismay. I had gone straight from this interview to lunch with Mr. Balfour and related my conversation with Faisal and reiterated my conviction regarding the attitude of the French. Mr. Balfour assured me, in a purely private capacity, that he was in agreement with me. Thereupon I begged him to clear Faisal's mind of illusions so that he might shape his course accordingly.
Caught between the priorities of the West and the extremists in Syria, Faisal was confronted by Arab nationalists demanding that he accept the crown of Syria. He cabled Lord Allenby in Cairo and asked for advice. If he accepted, he pointed out, it might be possible to fend off an uprising, but if he refused, it might cause one. The answer, when it came, was so evasive and vaguely worded that he allowed himself to be elected king. Neither Great Britain nor France acknowledged the coronation. Britain because she could not, France because she would not. In April 1920, at the San Remo conference, Syria was officially put under a French mandate. Damascus erupted. Faisal's position was impossible. The Syrians were calling him pro-French, the French were calling him pro-British, and the British were saying he was backing the cause of Arab extremism. General Gouraud, who arrived in Damascus as the first French High Commissioner, demanded from Faisal an unconditional recognition of the mandate. Then, on the 22nd of July, Arab tribesmen took the law into their own hands and attacked a French outpost. The following day, the French routed them and marched on to occupy Damascus. The resistance of the Arabs was not led by Faisal, noted Gertrude, and was in fact in defiance of his orders. General Gouraud immediately issued a proclamation beginning, "The Amir Faisal, who has brought this country to the brink of ruin, has ceased to reign." Faisal was ordered to leave Damascus within 24 hours. At this most inconvenient moment, Gertrude fell ill again with bronchitis, but her summer house in the garden received visitors at all hours, ostensibly to inquire after the state of her health, in reality to pour out their fears and aspirations. She gave up any hopes of a quiet recovery, donned her dressing gown, and in this most unsuitable of attire received a party of the distinguished Muslims of Baghdad, including the mayor and the son of the elderly Naqib, one of the most important religious nobles in Iraq. Cox called a special meeting to discuss the appointment of Arab ministers and held it in Gertrude's drawing room. He had made out a list of trusted and representative Arab candidates. The first cabinet choice would be the Naqib of Baghdad, His Reverend Sayyid Abdul Rahman Effendi. Elderly and venerated, he was also the head of the Sunni community. He, like Faisal, traced his descent from the Prophet. Cox went to see him, and after a short delay, he agreed to undertake the formation of the provisional government. The provisional cabinet was to run the country while it prepared for the first general election. Gertrude knew exactly the king she wanted for Mesopotamia. She wrote to her father,
"I feel quite clear in my own mind that there is only one workable solution, a son of the Sharif, and for choice, Faisal. Very, very much the first choice."
In March 1921, Churchill, the new Secretary of State for the Colonies, convened a conference of British officials in Cairo to consider the Middle East. He had picked Lawrence as his adviser on Arabian affairs. Lawrence, like Gertrude, thought Faisal the best solution for the crown of Iraq. The French, however, had to be sounded out first. The result was a condition. Faisal must give up all claims to Syria and all support for the Syrian nationalists. Faisal had agreed and was ready to abandon his father's claims to Palestine in return for the throne of Iraq for himself and that of the newly created Transjordan for his brother Abdullah. As a Sunni ruler in a country with a Shia majority, the Emir's descent from the Prophet would be his trump card. He should immediately be invited to Baghdad before elections for a ruler started. He would need to go to Mecca first and have his candidature announced from there. Support would grow as he progressed east. On the 11th of July, the Council of State, at the request of the Naqib, unanimously declared Faisal king. Cox, though greatly relieved, knew that a referendum must be held so as to confirm Faisal as the choice of the people. He and Gertrude had already framed the question, "Do you agree to Faisal as king and leader of Iraq?" and printed the papers. They would be circulated to a large number of tribal representatives, including 300 notables. The referendum proved almost unanimous in his favour. If Faisal's coronation held in Baghdad was a formal European ceremony, Ramadi was the Bedouin equivalent, a tribal gathering in his honour and the culmination of the gains of the Arab fight for independence. For Gertrude, too, it was the culmination of her long fight for the Arabs, the sensational climax of tribal joy and triumph, and an occasion on which she, though not the only Briton present, took the prime place amongst them as she stood on the dais beside Faisal, Ali Sulaiman, the powerful pro-British Sheikh of the Dulaim, and her great friend Fahad Beg of the Anazeh. Faisal entered the shadow of a black tent pitched by the Euphrates, 200 feet square, with its sides made of freshly cut branches. Inside, from the entrance to the dais at the far end, the tribesmen stood shoulder to shoulder. Faisal sat on the high divan, then he began to speak, leaning forward to beckon the men at the back to come nearer. There was a surge as some 500 men drew near and sank to the ground before him. He spoke to them as a tribal chief in his strong, musical voice.
He spoke in the great tongue of the desert, sonorous, magnificent, no language like it. "For 4 years," he said, "I have not found myself in a place like this or in such company." He told them how Iraq was to rise to their endeavours with himself at their head. He asked them, "Arabs, are you at peace with one another?" They shouted back, "Yes, we are at peace." "From this day, what is the date and what is the hour?" They answered him, "From this day," giving the Mohammedan date. "And from this hour," he continued, "any tribesman who lifts his hand against a tribesman is responsible to me. I will judge between you calling your sheikhs in council. I have my rights over you as your lord, and you have your rights as subjects, which it is my business to guard." His speech rolled on, punctuated with tribal cries of "Yes, by God," and "The truth, by God, the truth."
Fahad Beg and Ali Sulaiman stood up on either side of Faisal to swear allegiance, but the words they spoke were, "We swear allegiance to you because you are acceptable to the British government." Gertrude wrote,
"Faisal was a little surprised. He looked quickly round to me, smiling, and then he said, 'No one can doubt what my relations are to the British, but we must settle our affairs ourselves.' He looked at me again, and I held out my two hands, clasped together, as a symbol of the union of the Arab and British governments. It was a tremendous moment."
Sylvester Latuzel was reading from Queen of the Desert by Georgina Howell. The letters were read by Deborah Findlay. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters and is a Waters Company production for BBC Radio 4. When Woman's Hour in a couple of minutes, Fiona Shaw will talk about directing The Rape of Lucretia for the Glyndebourne Festival, and Bridget Christie will muse on the links between comedy and feminism.
Across the BBC, Rock and Roll America.
It sounded so different.
It spread like wildfire.
Electricity beyond comprehension.
Burning through prejudice.
It changes you inwardly.
Igniting teenage dreams.
This is what we've been waiting for.
It set the world ablaze.
It was like putting your finger in an electric socket.
From the fire starters who lit the fuse. Rock and Roll America. Tomorrow night at 9 on BBC 4.